want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I've been promising for some time a recap of the Boston Marathon bombing trial of Zhohar Tsarnaev. And the scrappy independent outlet that has done the best coverage of this trial is whowhatwhy.com. In a moment, editor and publisher Russ Baker will be joining us. And you'll be astounded by the number of open questions that were not addressed by the trial and may never be resolved. As always, this podcast is made possible by listeners who subscribe, people like Joe Carson, Chris Welsh, and Susan Gavet. I'm grateful to the people who support my work, and I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a link under my picture that says sign up. That takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever you can afford. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers earn a bonus gift. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Just 2 years after the April 15th, 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, Zhohar Tsarnaev has been convicted by a jury not of his peers and sentenced to death. Here's my old pal, the late Norton Buffalo.
Men, women, and children gathered round that hanging tree. And a word without a young man soon would die. But no one seemed concerned enough to tell his family of just exactly where his bones would lie. Oh, yes, they'd had a trial, but it didn't last too long.
Yeah, they had a trial, and it didn't last too long.
They sang that hanging song. They said, we're gonna hang you from that hanging tree, but what you done was in the first degree.
We'll send the preacher. Russ Baker joins us today. He's the editor and publisher of whowhatwhy.com, an online publication that has distinguished itself by doing the finest coverage of the trial and the investigation that led to it in Boston. Russ, thanks for being with us today.
I always enjoy it, Peter.
I promised my listeners that I would check in with you for a recap of these events once we had all of the results in. And it has been a wild ride. And let's first talk about the media, because as I said, your scrappy, you know, reader-funded organization has done an incredible job of skeptically reporting on a sequence of events that was highly controlled and had an element of political theater to it.
Well, it certainly did, and that scripting and that control was what caught my eye immediately after the bombing and led to an article which was actually published. The bombing was on a Monday. On Friday, we went live with an article just as this manhunt was sort of coming to its culmination. We got, for us as a small site, a lot of attention, probably 20,000 Facebook shares, that kind of thing. People were interested, were intrigued. And I my history is that whenever I see any large entity or the government quickly assuring us that there's nothing to see, that they've got it all sewn up and so forth, mm-hmm. that there is some kind of a cover-up going on. The rest of the time, they don't even bother to do that. And so I found that very troubling. And it looked to be a complex thing, and I wondered why we were not seeing a complex investigation. And we never saw a complex investigation, not by the government and not by the media. In fact, we saw no investigation at all by the media. The media, after all of the years and all of the fakery that is documented and lamented by the media, they went right back to home base, where they're comfortable, which is to just simply be stenographers to power.
Mm-hmm. And Russ, as I referenced on the introduction, this trial and the whole investigation is riddled with unanswered questions and obvious heavy-handed government control. And let's start with the fact that Tsarnaev was charged under federal law and therefore eligible for the death penalty because Massachusetts banned capital punishment a while back. And only about a third of the residents there in polls expressed support for the death penalty. So, you know, this was wobbly from the start in terms of our standards of criminal justice. Because Bigfoot federal government took control. This allowed the death penalty to be an option. And then, of course, they impaneled a jury that couldn't be his peers because all of them had to assert that they were willing to vote for a death verdict. And that skews the process to begin with. And as you covered in some detail, Judge O'Toole repeatedly refused to change the venue of the trial, despite all of the pretrial publicity and the clear bias. What did they have to interview, 1,200 people to impanel a jury?
Yeah. A couple of thoughts. First of all, the mere fact that the federal government was so insistent on him getting the death penalty deserves closer scrutiny. I can't say that I know why they did that, because the federal government usually does not push for the death penalty. It's only in very, very rare cases that they do. But they did in this case. And to me, the reason has something to do with an attempt to silence this fellow, Jahar Tsarnaev. He's been under incredibly strict restrictions, something called special administrative measures, where no one can get to him and speak to him. And this has always seemed strange to me, because this fellow was characterized by the government and in the trial as, along with his brother, lone wolves, two individuals connected to no larger entity or other people or terror organization, domestic or foreign, that they had no confederates of any kind, and yet he cannot speak to members of the media, to others, cannot make any kind of statements or explain himself. And why? I don't know the answer to that, but when you give somebody the death penalty, you put them in a situation where they're very restricted. Now, not everybody. For example, Mumia Abu-Jamal, been on death row for many, many years, was able to do radio appearances and all kinds of things. But so it's interesting to me now, why would he be able to have that kind of ability to speak? And Tsarnaev, they don't want him saying anything.
Well, let me just jump in to pursue that point, because there is a distinction. Mumia is a state-level prisoner in Pennsylvania, and he is no longer on death row. But you're correct. While he was on death row, he was permitted, and he sued to win that right, or what prison officials might consider to be a privilege. So I think there, once again, is the distinction between a federal and state prosecution and the terms of it.
Well, that's right. And what this means is that all of those things that Mumia was able to bring to bear are not available to Jahar Tsarnaev. Also, he was represented by a federal defender, and the main outside attorney they brought in Judy Clark is specialized in helping people avoid the death penalty. She mm-hmm. failed in this case, but they never presented any kind of a defense at all. In fact, we do know that they did some investigating early on. We are told that they told family members that they believed there were real problems with the government's case. One family member claims that, they were told by the defense that they believed him to be innocent, but that there was nothing that they could do. Mm. And the fact is, there is nothing that they can do because they've been limited at every turn. It's impossible to get information as to what really did happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, at the outset, in her opening statement, Judy Clark essentially conceded that Johar was present and was a participant. But, Russ, for me, the unexplored angle, and I do understand what her focus was. It was very narrow, simply on trying to avoid a capital sentence. However, I believe that there was a whole area that they could have explored of Johar as a patsy, and both brothers as patsies, because as you have reported and we've discussed previously, we have the uncle, Ruslan Sarni, who is the son-in-law of a major CIA operator named Graham Fuller. The uncle was involved with USAID. We know about the older brother Tamerlan's travels to Chechnya, his contact with the FBI at different times. And so, you know, there clearly are the outlines of larger players and the use of these brothers, as I would describe, as patsies. And that, to me, should have at least been opened up in the penalty phase of this trial.
Well, right. But you see, of course, if they were patsies, that immediately goes to the question of the involvement of state actors in this larger picture. And that immediately is verboten. You won't see the mainstream media practically ever even entertaining the possibility that the state could in some way, even accidentally, be complicit in something of this sort. And you won't see the so-called alternative media do it either. Nobody wants to touch this thing. They didn't want to do it with the assassination of John F. Kennedy or Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy or 9/11 or any of these other things. They didn't want to look at indications that the intelligence services had some kind of visibility on these figures, that there was money flowing from other people and entities in many of these situations. And so that is the default position, is that there's never any more to the story. And as you say, there are many things here which suggest, and I think any open-minded person looking at the things we've talked about on past shows or written about dozens of times on our site, Who, What, Why, is that the evidence points very heavily to there being more to the story, to them being either patsies or participants in something larger that they were instructed to do for unknown reasons.
Mm-hmm. And there are also so many ways that this trial seemed to be so heavily tilted in favor of the government. And one of the things, I'm going to link in the show file for this podcast, Russ, to your master page of coverage of the Boston Marathon case. And one of the things that I'm really pleased you did was to publish the blank form that the jury was required to fill out in the sentencing phase of the trial. And what became clear to me is how seriously overcharged the defendant was in this case. And let me just single out, for example, count six is allegedly about bombing, but then it also references the death of Officer Sean Collier, the MIT cop. Now, there were no bombs involved in that incident, and it's still unproven to me. The evidence is weak and circumstantial that the Tsarnaev brothers were actually involved in the death of Officer Collier. Yet this charge jumbled together the bombing events at the finish line and the alleged events 2 days later, 3 days later.
Yeah, I mean, the Officer Collier thing is in itself a giant question mark. that we've spent extensive effort looking at. It isn't clear that they killed this man. It's not clear that they would have been in that area. It's not clear that there was any reason for them to go there, to know that the officer was sitting there on a at night on a darkened campus, parked out of sight from the street. There's no particular reason that they would have known that he was there. They did not take his gun. They already had a gun. Not clear why you would compound an already difficult situation when the FBI was looking for them by then killing a police officer. And what intrigues me about the Officer Collier story is the parallels with Lee Harvey Oswald, another alleged patsy from exactly half a century before, 2013 to 1963, where, again, he was going to be have pinned on him a major a national event where it would be hard to prove that he did it, just as it was hard to prove that they planted those bombs at the Marathon bombing. But when you add in both cases, the same exact thing, the shooting of a police officer, you now aggravate the whole thing. You create an individual act that you can pin on them. And of course, what you do is during a manhunt by law enforcement, you give law enforcement a reason to be much more aggressive in pursuing these suspects, and really with a kind of a mindset where they were likely not to come out of it alive. And we know this is a fact, that police officers have a fraternal code, one for all and all for one, and any one of them that's down, everybody else responds with particular vigor. And that's, I think, what we saw happen in Boston. So the Officer Collier thing is troubling on many, many different fronts. It also turns out that Collier ran in similar circles to Tamerlan Tsarnaev. They both were involved in a boxing club, and they both knew some of the same people. So even connections through the schools that people attended. So a lot of fascinating things that really should have been dug into.
Mm-hmm. But if you would comment directly on my point that the Collier killing was rolled up in a charge related to bombing, and the fact that given the flimsy basis for the Collier charge to begin with, the fact that the jury ratified this count up to and including a death penalty outcome is really troubling to me, because it suggests that they didn't really analyze this very carefully.
Right. Well, see, it's two weak things. It's the question of whether they were the authors of the bomb and whether they were the murderers of Officer Collier. They're both weak, but by tying them together, they complicate things. And so I think that was a strategic decision to sort of overwhelm people with the, if you will, enormity of the dual crime, and hope that nobody looked very carefully at either of them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many other things that occurred. Let me ask you, as you monitored the trial reporting on a daily basis, could you single out some of the things that really just struck you as gratuitous or, so clearly in favor of the government that the judge allowed and the defense either was unsuccessful in challenging or didn't even try?
There were many different things. The first thing I noticed was that there were tremendous resources poured into having us wallow in the bloodshed itself, in the personal tragedies. This was so constant that it seeped, I think, deep into our subconscious. And that looked to me like a calculated propaganda effort to do it to that extent, because there are many tragic things that happen and we don't hear about or from the victims very much, but we heard constantly leading up to and during the trial again and again and again until we got to know the victims unusually well. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a deliberate effort. The second thing was that there was a kind of a grotesque and excessive siding with the prosecution in seeking to caricature the defendants in the worst possible way. And so everything that they did, this Johar Tsarnaev as a 19-year-old, if he put up some kind of a video, they made more of it than one might have. Mm-hmm. You probably know about the instance where he was in prison, in isolated and solitary confinement, and there was a camera on him, and he started goofing around like a 19-year-old might, making different gestures. And at one point, he gave the camera his middle finger, and this was then turned by the media during the trial into, well, this is this guy giving the middle finger to all these people who died. But in fact, that doesn't necessarily follow. And in fact, he also flashed a peace sign, which they didn't bother to tell us about.
Well, and Russ, this in particular offended me because, you know, here's a guy who's in isolation. He's on camera under surveillance at all times. And in this moment, whatever it was, whether he was flipping off a guard or just, you know, horsing around, under the circumstances, it's grossly unfair to deny him any privacy rights and just pop out this one section of the video. As you pointed out, they selectively edited to get the flipping of the bird, but didn't show the sequence before or after. And so this kind of tactic just really screams injustice.
Yeah, and I have to say the judge absolutely did not seem to be being much of a judge in the Solomonic sense, that he seemed very, very prejudiced toward the prosecution. And I can understand that because the government created an atmosphere very early on, and the media was only too happy to be complicit, where it really was like a hanging crowd. I mean, there was just tremendous emotions coursing through everything and everybody. There wasn't a lot of analysis or thinking or introspection. And so in that kind of an environment, it's professional suicide, whether you're a judge or you're a journalist, to not really go along with it. And so why did he even permit that image? I mean, many judges would have said, absolutely, we're not going to include this because it's not germane to proving the crime.
And highly prejudicial.
That's right.
I mean, I can't think of another case where something like this that is so irrelevant was permitted, and it was used at least in the public venue. I can't speak to the court proceedings, but it was used by the media to say, here is this kid who is so arrogant and unremorseful that he, you know, is just cavalier about the whole proceeding and the fact that he might be facing the death penalty, and so he's flipping the bird. And,
right.
You know, it feeds the mentality of vengeance and the kind of public political theater that this trial, I think, was intended to be.
Yeah, and that gets to my earlier point that for some reason that we can only speculate about, it has been seen as absolutely crucial by the federal government that this guy get the death penalty. Now, again, I wonder why. If they've caught the perpetrator and they can put him away for life, why is it so important that he be executed? That, I think, is something we need to keep digging into.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to commend your team of reporters, James Henry, Joanne Potter, Laura Turner, and let's see, Jeff Taylor, I guess.
Jill Vaglica.
Oh, Jill, yeah. Too. Okay. And one of the questions I think it was Laura raised was, why they didn't permit Johar to testify, again, even in the penalty phase. And I do understand the thinking of a defense attorney, because the most difficult part of putting your defendant on the stand is the cross-examination by the government. And this can lead to a lot of loose ends and compounded errors, I might call it. But once the verdict was in and it was so unified and unanimous, it does seem that Judy Clark could have taken the risk. And in this effort to humanize her client and to win relief in the form of life without parole, Laura Turner was essentially second-guessing that. What are your thoughts about it at this point?
It's very hard to know what the right strategy is. Like you, I understand why they might decide that there was no advantage to putting him on the stand. You know, what would he say? I mean, there are two options. One is he'd say, I did it. I think it would be hard to humanize somebody who said, I did it, no matter what they said or what their explanation was. And then, you know, what if he started to say, I did it because I saw the effects of American drones killing innocent people, and I thought, well, you know, this cannot stand, or something like that. That, I think, would be problematical for everyone, for someone to make a political statement of that sort. Now, the alternative is for him to say, that's not what happened. You know, my brother told me there was something going on and we had to go to the marathon and I was supposed to wear a, you know, white backpack and he was supposed to wear a black band and we were supposed to go to separate spots and something was going to happen and I didn't know a lot about it, but this was not what I was expecting. And that wouldn't have been acceptable either. But I have to say, there's a difference between the purpose of a trial. The purpose of a trial is not to get to the truth.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important point. I think we did a piece about that. Mm-hmm. But the purpose of journalism, certainly, is to get to the truth. And so we don't consider the trial, before the trial, during the trial, and after the trial, we think that these kinds of inquiries, the kind of conversation that you and I are having now, are very important and need to go on. Because if we didn't get the truth from the trial, and I believe we did not, then justice is not served. And the broader public interest of knowing what the heck is going on in our world is not served either unless we continue to dig.
Well, and your version of journalism is one that I embrace, Russ. But you put up a link to a video clip. This was a couple of months back. And WGBH is the public TV station in Boston. People know it because of a lot of the great syndicated programs that show up on local PBS stations. It's the originator of Frontline, for example. But they have a local show where they bring on reporters and chew on the news and politics of the moment. And in one of these rather damning episodes, the topic was, should we refer to Zhohar Tsarnaev as the alleged Boston bomber? And as a group with, I think, one dissenter, they all said, who cares? We know he's guilty. It's so obvious. Why should we play the game of calling him accused and alleged and use that language? And this, to me, is a real turning point where people who are on television, who are working journalists, turn on the standards of their profession. And do it to be popular. Do it to be part of the consensus move there, or the consensus attitude in Boston. And I was further floored when one of the members of that panel showed up on the PBS NewsHour as the unbiased reporter who was covering the trial. And she had already tipped her hand that she thought it was kind of quaint to refer to Tsarnaev as alleged or accused.
It's a great point, Peter, and it goes to the heart of our distress over the state of journalism in America. We think that it has gotten worse over the years, not better. We haven't learned much of anything. It's gotten worse. We think it's much worse than it was decades ago. We don't think people would have done that then. We hope they wouldn't have done it then. It's just grossly inappropriate, and it suggests that they're not even journalists at all, because that is not our job to say everybody knows so-and-so did it, because, well, first of all, there hasn't been a trial yet, so you can't say that. And second of all, even after a trial, it's still okay to say we're not sure they did it. You know, that is, it's our job to ask the questions and to dig. But if we begin, and by the way, I talk to people across all sectors and professions, and they say, why are you looking into this thing? I mean, everybody knows they did it. Now, this term, everybody knows, is extremely insidious. How does everybody know anything?
Well, and I would refer you to a powerful song by Leonard Cohen that's called Everybody Knows. And if you listen to the lyrics that he wrote, it echoes what you're saying right now.
I love Leonard Cohen.
So, Russ, a couple of other things just that I have some notes about here. Was there anything introduced at the trial whatsoever related to the interrogation and death of Ibrahim Todishev in Florida?
I can't say for certain because I wasn't in the courtroom for much of the time. And by the way, the transcripts are enormously expensive. This is another thing. I don't think we wrote about that, but they're hugely expensive. We haven't been able to even buy the transcripts. And of course, you had no cameras in the courtroom and so forth. So it's very, very hard to even know what took place. I do not remember that was ever mentioned at all. And the shooting of Todishev, the defense, I think, but it would have been complicated to try to bring that in because the judge would have said that it was not material to the case. The defense would have had the challenge of presenting a much larger tapestry of problems associated with this. And even the fact that they really weren't allowed to talk about the older brother very much, I think, handicapped them, because it's all part of this bigger picture. To understand what was really going on, you do have to look at Todishev, you do have to look at Tamerlan Tsarnaev, you do have to look at the uncle and his CIA connections, you do certainly have to look at the curious relationship with the FBI prior to the bombing. You have to look at all of these things, and they really looked at, frankly, none of them. The whole trial, as I said, was this sort of maudlin display of things that are upsetting on a gut level, but don't actually teach us anything about what actually happened.
Sure, high levels of emotional content.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that same vein, Russ, I know that they played many video clips from the surveillance footage in order to place both brothers at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. They, in close-ups, depicted Johar dropping his backpack near the child who was killed. And what I'm wondering is if in any of those videos, did we see the people in the black windbreakers with Kraft International on them? These were the unexplained law enforcement or quasi-law enforcement people who were there that day, who swarmed as soon as the bombs were detonated, who appeared to interact with FBI and other law enforcement officers as if they were on the same team and knew each other. And yet I've never seen any adequate explanation of who Kraft International was, why they were contracted to be there that day. And I'm just wondering if they showed up in any of these videos or did they edit them out?
I think you can see them in the background and some of these things, but they never talk about them, and the defense never asks, and so this is the problem. Why? Who were these people? Why were they there? They had black backpacks. What about the backpack color? The picture they showed of the exploded backpack that was supposedly Johar Tsarnaev's was black. Now, it could be that it had been horribly charred, but it doesn't look like it. It looks like a bag that was blown apart, but not singed in that way. And it looks like it was originally a black backpack, and they refer to it as a black backpack. But in fact, when you look at the backpack that he's wearing, it's white or a light gray. So that would seem, if you were the defense attorney, the first thing you'd say is, If the glove does not fit, you must acquit, you know. If the backpack is wrong, there's something amiss here. And that would be huge. As you point out, these figures with the insignia of this private contractor sort of mercenary outfit, the fact that they are there present in force, the fact that they instantly take control of the whole scene. I mean, this is huge. It's huge. And the fact that nobody's ever come forward to explain, neither Kraft, who we tried to speak to, nor the government has ever explained who those people were or why they were there or what they were doing. By the way, even if you talk about Johar and his backpack, they don't actually show him putting down his backpack. They show a little dip of his shoulder, which may be him dropping his backpack, or it may not be. It may be just him dipping for some reason, which we do sometimes when we're walking or we're standing, we're adjusting ourselves, adjusting a strap, so we don't know. There is a photo of what looks to be a white backpack near him, but the fact of the matter is, if you're wearing a backpack and you go to an event and there's a crowd around you, maybe pressing up against you, you don't normally continue to wear the backpack. You take it off. I don't wonder why the defense didn't point that out, that there were probably hundreds or thousands of people at that event who had backpacks who took them off. So that, again, doesn't prove anything. And there's another thing. There was a black bag that a woman put. We're still looking at all these things. She put somewhere near a railing. And then there's another picture with that bag in front of the railing. How did that bag get in front of the railing? And could that not have been the bomb? There are so many questions surrounding this thing. I mean, it's almost too many to enumerate.
And Russ, we heard conflicting testimony from government witnesses, some who said that making a bomb with a pressure cooker is not that difficult, and, you know, you can get the instructions from books or off the internet. And then there were others who said, well, you know, it's not so easy to create these things and to get them to actually the work to work as intended. Did the defense draw out those contradictions effectively?
Well, they didn't. And not only did experts, but I mean, basically the government early on suggested that they didn't think that these two could have made that bomb. The website where they supposedly got the instructions, an Al-Qaeda website, actually has a comment there saying that this is actually difficult to do, to actually pull this off. The government admitted that the bombs don't seem to have been made in their apartments or dorm room, and that they don't know where they were made. And so the overall impression that we were given was that the bombs were probably not made by them and not made on their premises. Now, that's extraordinary, extraordinary. And as you address, I mean, the fact that the defense never brought any of this up, as far as I know, again, another bizarre failure to serve their client's interests, I would think. But again, this gets back to a decision that they apparently made at some point, was that they could never win on the merits, that the stuff they wanted to find they couldn't get, or if they could get it, that the judge was not going to allow it to be presented at trial. And so they basically gave up and tried to save this guy's life.
And I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask anyway. Was there any evidence or testimony to describe that there was some sort of a regional drill sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security that was underway at the Boston Marathon that day?
There was never any discussion of it. That's another one of these big holes in the story. And it seems a simple thing. Either there was a drill or there wasn't. Now, we know that there were a number of drills going on. We found brochures and things indicating drills over a period of time in Massachusetts at major events. We know that the Boston Marathon was considered to be an important event to be ready for. We know that one of the runners, a track coach from a major university who runs in lots of marathons, stated on television shortly after the bombing that he heard an announcement that there was a drill going on. And yet we hear no more about that. Why is this man not interviewed? Why was he not testifying? What is the government's answer? Was there a drill or was there not a drill? So again, it's Peter, the whole thing is surreal, because how can you have the very big core issues not being addressed? It would be like the O.J. trial where, O.J. was spotted in a cafe in Switzerland that day, and then that would just not come up.
Yeah. No, it is, words fail me, but bizarre attempts to describe how I view all this. Now, in your excellent pretrial coverage, Russ Baker, you raised a lot of questions about this murky figure named Danny, who is a student, I think, at MIT, drove a very expensive car, was the alleged victim of the carjacking incident with the brothers, where they allegedly admitted responsibility for the Boston Marathon bombing. Are you any more comfortable with Danny now that you know his actual identity and that he has testified under oath?
No. And as you mentioned, we put a lot of effort into studying him, into trying to talk to him. We found anomalies with his story. We found him telling different versions of it, which suggested that that story had been crafted under some kind of duress or encouragement to be a better story. And in one version of it, he basically suggested that he wasn't carjacked at all, if carjacking means that you are let's put it this way, that he was not a hostage at all, that his car may have been taken or he may have given it to them. And then the story became that he was a hostage for a short amount of time, and then it became that he was a hostage for a longer amount of time, and then that he was a hostage for a really long amount of time. Also, the stories of if he was a hostage, how he escaped changed. The first account we found, he basically said that they left him alone in the car while one went in to pay for gas and the other pumped gas, and he opened the door and ran out of the car, which is not a very good story of ruthless, single-minded people. But then that story quickly changed to being that he was sitting next to the elder brother who put the gun down for a moment, and that then he bolted. This is hugely problematical for the whole story. Danny himself is problematical because, like the elder Tsarnaev, he is a foreign national, vulnerable to the national security state because he needs to stay on its good side. It's exactly the kind of person, again, that these agencies target for cooperation. The hijacking didn't make a whole lot of the carjacking didn't make a whole lot of sense. And very importantly, Danny plays this crucial role of saying, I got a confession from Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who's now dead. He told me that they did the bombing and they planted the bomb and they killed the officer. And so this went right out into our subconscious. And that's why everybody says we know they did it. Well, how do they know they did it? They think they saw the bomb being put down and that it was the same bomb, which they didn't see any of that. They think they know that there was a confession, but we don't know that there was a confession. And by the way, the confession was supposedly made by Tamerlan Tsarnaev without his brother even being in earshot. So the brother couldn't even testify as to whether his supposedly dominating older brother even said that to this man. And then you have the logical question of, now you have these two guys running for their lives, why are they even getting another car? Why are they putting themselves at risk in a carjacking scenario when they already have a car? If they're going to take a car, why take it with them? Why would you confess gratuitously to these other things when you already have a gun? It seems to be enough to get somebody to cooperate. And by confessing, you just put yourselves at much, much more risk. So none of this makes any kind of sense as far as I can figure.
Russ, what you've just enumerated there, in ordinary circumstances, would be the basis for significant appeals and calls of a mistrial. And yet, because of the nature of this and the collusion of the media, which, you know, the corporate outlets do not challenge any of these assertions by the government. And now that it's all neatly wrapped up in convictions and the order for an execution, it's real easy to just sideline all of these troubling details and say, oh, well, who cares? You know, they've already admitted he was there, he did it, he had some responsibility, and we're going to move on because, after all, the NBA playoffs are upcoming, you know?
Well, the media has been so ghastly in this whole thing. And when I have been interviewed, and you may see, I mean, it was a profile of me in Boston Magazine. I was interviewed on WGBH, Boston.com wrote something about us. But they don't, none of these outfits ever seem to see fit to ask any of these questions. And then if you talk to them about it, they go, yeah, but then who knows what happened? I mean, maybe, you know, maybe he did confess. I mean, who knows? You know, like they're not even, they're really like sort of shrug, and it's really as if, hey, we're not journalists. I mean, who said we were journalists? We just play them on TV.
Yeah. And Russ, in that same vein, I want to commend you because you presented an interview with Masha Gessen at whowhatwhy.com. She wrote a book called The Brothers, in which she asks a lot of the questions that you are raising. And I'm only a little bit envious because her publisher turned me down for an interview. And I believe it's because they wanted to sell more books without raising the profile of the troubling questions that Masha Gessen raised. And I'm just curious if you had any difficulty in securing that interview, because I was frankly stunned when the PR rep just said, oh, no, we're not scheduling any more interviews for Ms. Gessen.
I was not involved with arranging that. I didn't even know that that was happening, that we give our podcasters complete free rein to do whatever they want to do. And I never really know. We never really know who they've secured. Sometimes they will tell us they're trying to get somebody, and we'll say, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, from what I recall of that interview, she's in a difficult position, and some of our readers even commented on it, that she can see that the story doesn't hold up, but she also is, like most journalists, she's struggling to maintain her career, mm-hmm. Working for publishing with large publishing houses and getting on media shows and big, you know, public radio shows and what have you, and getting the ability to write for places like the Washington Post. And if you go too far off the reservation, you don't get that work anymore. That's how it is. And mm-hmm. I know that from my own career. You are not allowed to bring these things up. And so she had to handle it with tremendous delicacy, both in her book and in the interviews that she did. She cannot come out and say whatever may be on her mind. She's got to be very cautious about it. And that's what all so-called mainstream journalists face. That's the challenge. You either go along with the big lie or you strategically point out some holes without going out of bounds.
So, Russ, take a moment here to tell my listeners what this has cost you in terms of assembling this team of reporters to provide coverage that we were denied by the, you know, major corporate media outlets. And, you know, for example, how much money do you need to get those transcripts if people want to get out their checkbooks and credit cards and help you at Who, What, Why?
Yeah, I mean, these kinds of stories, I mean, we pride ourselves on doing things as leanly as possible. And we also use volunteers as much as we can and so forth. And nobody's getting rich off of this. But we do certainly need to raise funds urgently to continue the work on this story. That's an absolute given. And I also want to mention, by the way, because you mentioned the mainstream media, but the alternative media has done nothing on this either.
Yeah, you're right.
With only a few exceptions, you take your favorite liberal, left, progressive magazine, website, they haven't said a word about this, not any of them. Not even the so-called, the people, you know, were famous for engaging with national security whistleblowers. They haven't said a single word about this. They're terrified of this story. And there are consequences. I faced them as a former, credentialed, acceptable journalist who has gone more and more into the realm of just telling the truth as it is without worrying about the consequences, and it has been challenging. So Who, What, Why is our, it's our dream operation. We think it has the potential to really shake things up and change the way journalism operates and the way people understand our system and our society. And we are just putting it out there for the public. We're saying, we cannot do this without you, because we're not taking ads, we're not taking partners or investors or anything. It's for you and by you, and we really need you to step up. That's really what we're asking.
Well, Russ, my respect for you and your colleagues has only grown through your stubborn, independent approach to covering this story with appropriate skepticism, continuing to ask the unanswered questions and delve into the areas where there appear to be cover-ups or spin-ups of what actually happened. And while this, you know, chapter is going to be slammed shut, and most people will move on and just accept the official narrative, I, for one, am not going to forget how hard you worked on this story and how important your coverage has been, in my humble opinion.
Thank you very much, Peter. It means a lot to me.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, and I want to recommend that people drop by whowhatwhy.com for other stories that you cover on the same basis, and we will be in touch, Russ. Thanks for joining us today.
You bet.
Well, it's clear Zhohar Tsarnaev will take many secrets to his grave, and our government has made sure of that.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.